Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 114 of Real Blend, a podcast that just wants to go back to the movie theaters. Aww. And we might have some news on that coming up soon, a light at the end of the tunnel. But we are back on YouTube Live. We're recording everybody here, so you can see that I am Sean O'Connell, the Managing Director of Cinema Blend, joined, as always, by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago, where it snowed today. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
It snowed today and everyone's freaking out, but do you guys remember where we were a year ago today?
Don't do that. That's
we
sad.
Were in Chicago together for Star Wars Celebration for the meetup, and what happened? It snowed.
It snowed also, yes. And people at the time said this is relatively normal, and like April snow is
It's not entirely, I mean, it sucks, but it's not entirely out of the question. I remember thinking at the time that it was fun because it was the day of the premiere episode of Game of Thrones. And so it was a very winter is coming. And then also you could make the joke that that was Chicago cosplaying as the planet Hoth. So,
yes, it was.
So, you know, it is what it is. It happens.
And Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. got stranded in in an airport. And you were describing everybody in the baggage claim department, the sheer amount of people.
Lauren and I were literally on the plane.
You were on the plane. I remember that.
Right.
We were on
it was Gabe in the baggage claim. That's right.
Yeah.
And like, but do you guys remember how we all had such a great time watching Game of Thrones together? We ordered pizza and we got a couple of beers. And you remember how Sean basically said, F you guys? I'd literally rather get in a car and drive across the country than spend one extra night. You guys remember that?
I mean, across the country or to St. Louis, which is just a few hours away.
I don't know. Yeah, it's the Midwest.
Yes, everything's close to that. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Hey, good to see you, Sean, Jake, Gabe. I mean, that was a really cool, obviously a great moment for our show to have that amazing meetup in Chicago. Star Wars Celebration was super special. But yeah, it was really funny, the idea of winter or snow keeping us in Chicago. But I'm glad we all got to watch it together. Just bummed how that season turned out. But, you know, oh well.
It is what it is. Hopefully we can get excited about it.
Remember when that was our biggest concern?
Yeah. Remember how big
ending
of a deal
Game
that
of Thrones
was? Yeah. Do you remember? That was also the same weekend where I was at the AT&T store.
Yeah.
And I went to visit the throne, and the next person in line to get a picture of the throne was Kathleen Kennedy. And then I took a photo with Kathleen Kennedy, myself, and Lauren at the throne. The weirdest part about that is, now looking back on it, she was there because she's a Game of Thrones fan, but she also was getting ready to do a trilogy with the creators of Game of Thrones for Star Wars. Remember, at that point, they were still doing it. So I remember her telling me that she was basically there to support them. I mean, she was there for Star Wars, clearly, but she went to the store because she wanted to support Game of Thrones and like send the photo to like D.B. Weiss and Benioff or whatever their names are. But
didn't she lean over and whisper in your ear, and then I'm going to fire them?
No, that did not happen. I am a Kathleen Kennedy fan, but that did not happen. She did say, Kevin, I am very sorry for the Solo name scene. And she was just very, so thank you. She did not say that. I'm kidding, but I wish she did.
You know, you don't have to like clarify that she didn't say that. You know that like you can let the joke rest.
No.
Just let it breathe.
There's a thing called the internet.
That don't need to be said.
There's a thing called the internet where people can splice out exact things you
say.
Oh,
dude, we are 100 plus episodes into this show. The internet can now make us say anything that they want us to say.
Oh, that's true. That's kind of scary. All right, episode highlights. We are going to dive into actual movie news, Dune photos, and Jake is going to give us a tutorial about all the reasons why we should be excited for it.
Yes!
We have an interview on this week's show with the great Michael Shannon, who's promoting a film called The Quarry, and we also talk about a number of films from his past. Gabe wants me to point out that we aren't on YouTube Live. Did I say YouTube Live?
You
I
did.
Just meant YouTube.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say that. No. And everybody, for some reason, wants us to do Facebook Live, but I don't get what the point of doing Facebook Live is. It's
I think because they can comment. Is it because they can, like, actively talk to us?
Oh, we don't want that. That would be horrible.
We barely even want each other's comments.
Right, exactly. I'm muting the text thread constantly. but I will send you guys over to the Facebook community page where you can comment left and right on all the threads that you guys will create. Head over there and search for Real Blend Podcast Community. As you now can see, we're posting these episodes on Cinema Blend's YouTube page. We're going to do a big blowout advertisement to let people know that we are back to doing video once Jake's video actually works. So he's not a cartoon head in all of the episodes. And of course, we're available wherever all your favorite podcast apps are. So if you aren't already subscribed, do so now. Tell a friend, and then we'll have a review at the end of the show. Thank you guys for pushing us over 100 reviews on the iTunes little OCD thing asked for last week. Yes, now we're at 101.
Wait, did you get to see it be 100?
No, I didn't. Oh, I went and saw it at 101. and we got one real review, and then one person who said they were posting it just to get us to 100, and they ended up effing
out. No!
So, but listen, you meant well, and I appreciate the effort. That was very nice, you guys. So now we have to get to like 110, just around. I need a round number. It's sick. It's really weird.
Whenever you change the volume on your TV, does it have to be in like a numerical of 5 or a numerical of 10?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it does.
I'm weird. I'm 3, 5 and 7 and 11. If anything is a 6 or a 13, I know those are like generically like negative numbers, but those are the, I can't do something 6 times. It has to be 3, 5, or 7 from my OCD.
Kev, what about the numbers on Lost? Do they mess with you?
No, don't say anything yet. He doesn't know much.
Does he not know about the numbers?
Wait, do you know about 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42?
Numbers is the episode that I'm getting ready to watch.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I almost blew it. I almost said something significant.
So literally the next episode I'm going to hit play on today is Hurley's backstory, right? That's So Lauren, my wife Lauren, has been watching all of these episodes with me. She's seen Lost twice now, all the way through. And she's getting a kick out of watching me react to it. I thankfully don't really know anything. I remember hearing about the final episode when it aired. I don't remember much about what the context is. I know there's the debate about whether or not they're dead or alive. That's fine. But right now I'm just in it. And I will say this, and I know we have to move on, but to give Jake credit, Lost is, it's one of the richest stories I've ever heard in regards to character development. I'm just blown away by the way my mind expected these characters to be, who they were going to be, and who they've turned out to be. Right now, I'm all in on Sawyer. I think he's my favorite character in the show. Awesome. I think that character is so layered.
It's going to, like, your favorite character, I think, and Sean, you can agree or disagree, it's going to shift throughout the show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And a shout out to Larry Fong and, like, the cinematography on that show is mind-blowing. Like, the transfer I'm watching on my Blu-ray is unbelievable. It shot 35mm. It is just an incredible show.
It's like, there will never be a show like that on network television again. Like, you look at that and you think, like, oh, I bet that was on HBO or something. But it wasn't. It was on network TV and had commercials.
I don't understand. Like, so one of the things I'm doing with it, with the Blu-ray, which is kind of cool, and for people out there who haven't seen Lost, or if you want to rewatch Lost, this is actually kind of an interesting thing. If you get the Blu-ray set, the Blu-ray acts as the television series. So it gives you previously ons before the episode starts, and you get the exact to black breaks when they go to commercial breaks, which is kind of cool. I think it makes me feel like I'm watching it on TV.
But isn't that like if you watch any show that had commercial breaks, don't they do that? Like if you watch them on Netflix?
I think sometimes what they'll do is they'll either go right to the next scene. They generally do go to black, but
Call Saul goes to black.
I think it depends on whether or not, because I haven't seen Saul on Netflix because I've watched it on the network.
It goes to black.
Yeah. By the way, anybody out there watching Better Call Saul, if you're not caught up on this season,
I'm not on five.
I'm not going to say anything, but the last two episodes of this season, season 5, are going to blow your mind. Sean, I don't know where you're at yet, but just wait, man.
It's not Breaking Bad, man. I don't think it touches Breaking Bad.
All right, we got to move on. This week's poll. We threw out this because this was from our text chain, I'm pretty sure, right? It's Paul Thomas Anderson. We were talking about the fact that Jake was watching Magnolia, and then he was going down this rabbit hole of Paul Thomas Anderson films. We started to talk about why some of us don't like Magnolia as much as the others do. I have issues with Magnolia. I need to revisit it. It's not one that I've seen in a while.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah, and that's I'll fire it up then. I just remember not really liking it as much the first time I saw it, and mainly the characters. Certain characters are just really unlikable, and then I remember Julianne Moore's character being really, really unlikable. I do think Cruise is fantastic in it, and I'm sure that now that I'm catching up with it, or will catch up with it later on, it's a different movie. Then we talked about Inherent Vice and the text chain back and forth, but I wanted to put a poll up. I ended up putting up this week's weekly poll, and we started talking about Paul Thomas Anderson. I asked people which Paul Thomas Anderson film is better, but I only gave you two choices. I didn't want to give an other in this one because it would give you an out. I needed people to choose between Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood, which I think are largely considered to be his two top films. I mean, people will argue Punch Drunk Love or Phantom Thread or something like that, but those two seem to stand out as being the ones. So, Kev, I'm going to put it to you. If you had to choose between those two, There Will Be Blood or Boogie Nights, which one do you think won? This is best, not favorite.
I mean, knowing our listeners, I would imagine There Will Be Blood because, like, that is, but those are two of his best movies, no question whatsoever. Arguably, though, I would argue the best movie he's ever made is Phantom Thread cinematic.
You think technically that's better than There Will Be Blood? Wow.
I do. I think Phantom Thread has, in my opinion, I just found it to be a more enjoyable experience. There Will Be Blood is a...
Interesting.
It's funny because we're talking about films that are both 10 out of 10s here. These are masterpiece level cinematic achievements. It's funny, we discuss best and favorite a lot. I would argue that our viewers, our listeners definitely went with There Will Be Blood, but Boogie Nights is definitely right there. I mean, these are movies that are arguably loved by everybody who loves cinema, essentially, in my opinion.
So they did. They went with There Will Be Blood, but it was really close. It was 54% to 45%. There Will Be Blood ended up prevailing. And that's like it's separated by a hair, essentially, and a ton of votes, too. So thank you, everybody who voted in the weekly poll.
It's funny, though, because like to Jake's point about like the surprise of Phantom Thread being my favorite or the best thing he's ever made. Phantom Thread was a film that I got to luckily experience in 70mm at the Arclight in L.A. And there's something about that experience that will always be, I guess, personally magical to me. But also, I was also there when they curated a playlist because PTA had a playlist curated 30 minutes prior to the movie. Now, again, these are all factors that went into my experience with the movie, which obviously go into how I feel about the experience of the movie. So clearly those are things you have to take into account. I just think Phantom Thread is him working at his most masterful level as a director so far. And I think that everything he's done, you know, Punch Drunk Love is amazing. There Will Be Blood is amazing. I would rather watch There Will Be Blood over Phantom Thread. But I do think Phantom Thread is probably his greatest cinematic achievement. But it's funny, Jake and I were discussing earlier, about Boogie Nights. It's a much more rewatchable film. It's not an enjoyable film, but it's much more entertaining. Wow. It flows well. There are so many iconic scenes in Boogie Nights. You know, I was joking with you guys about growing up. When I was a kid, my parents wouldn't let me watch R-rated movies of certain kinds. I don't know how your parents were. I'd love to know how your parents were because
I was the house that other kids came over to because my parents would let me watch whatever movie I wanted to watch.
So there's where it gets interesting. My parents were cool about R-rated violence, but I was not allowed to watch any sex or nudity. So I remember
what messes up Americans.
Right.
It's so hypocritical.
You remember when I talked to Jamie, when we had Jamie Lee Curtis on Real Blend, I specifically told her about a story where when I was watching True Lies for the first time, they let me watch all the violence in the film. But then when she danced, they made me close my eyes. And I wanted to get her opinion on that as a mother of her own child.
Great
and kind
question.
Of. And so flip side of that, Boogie Nights was one of those films that fell into that window of Kevin, you can't watch this because this was like, based on the porn industry.
But that's legitimately,
there's a difference between we're not letting you watch this sort of striptease dance versus a movie about the porn industry that ends with a dude literally like hanging his dick out.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, Wow. But weirdly enough, you think about this particular movie, though, and that was the quintessential Kevin you can't watch, right? So my buddy Scott was, Scott was you, Jake. So I would go over to Scott's house, and Scott's parents would let us watch everything. And Scott's parents went on a date that night. So me, my buddy Brian, Scott, we all went over, and Dan, and we sat around the couch.
What was it about that movie that made you guys, was it just like, oh my God, guys, there's a movie about porn? Like, what was it that made a bunch of, like, young teenage boys want to watch Boogie Nights?
I'm trying to remember the so if it came out in what, you said 96 97,
like 97.
Okay,
because Magnolia was 99,
right? So I was 13 when Boogie Nights came out, so I'm freshman in high school. You know, we all heard about the film, my parents went and saw it. Remember, if your parents say, Kevin, you can't watch this movie, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna go watch the first movie.
Right. Yeah,
because they're basically saying, Kevin, this is one you are not allowed to watch. I'm like, well, what's in this movie that I can't see?
Did they see it and tell you this? Okay, saw it. It's because my parents used to just, like, flat out, like, sight unseen, just be like, oh, no, you can't see that.
So my folks actually go to the movies once a week. They always have. That's kind of where I fell in love with film. So they always went on Friday nights to the new release that weekend. I'll never forget them going to see True Lies without me, Terminator 2 without me. I'll just never forget those nights those babysitters so came over.
Damn it, Jill.
They came Terminator back and they 2. Were like, it was so awesome.
In my parents' defense.
And I'm picturing like a little tiny Kevin with a regular adult-sized head, but just like a little tiny Kevin, just like waving his little arms.
But I was 8 years old when T2 came out. So real quick on the Boogie Nights thing. So I go over to Scott's house, and his parents are out for a date night or whatever, and we start the film, and we think we're the coolest kids on the planet because we're watching Boogie Nights. There's nudity in the movie. We're, you know, we're 13-year-old boys. We're hanging out in the house. And then all of a sudden, his mom walks in right during, like, this hot tub scene. If I remember correctly, the hot tub scene had, like, two naked women in the hot tub during this, like, particular scene. Thankfully, she didn't walk in during Julianne Moore and Mark Wahlberg's
scene. I feel like there are worse scenes in that movie they could have walked in.
Or Roller Girl. But that particular scene, I just remember her walking in, and we all froze because we were, like, looking at the screen. There's nudity on the screen, and then there's four guys sitting around the couch. And she was like, hey, guys, and then just walked away. That was it. I'll just never forget
feel like,
that moment.
Know, it's a law of the universe that if you are watching a 3-hour movie that has a 30-second sex scene, your parents are going to walk in the room during that. It's just the way the universe works.
Yeah. But I never really understood it. And I know we have to move on, but I wanted to ask Sean this question, Gabe, if you don't mind real quick. You're a dad.
Yeah.
When you were showing your kids, first of all, when did you allow your kids to watch R-rated movies? And what are your thoughts on violence and sex and nudity? Are you the opposite?
It's so, so PJ probably started seeing his first R-rated movies when he was 15? No. Mm. Yeah, 15. I don't think it was 14. Although I think I showed him Die Hard and Speed. Is Speed R?
Speed is R. Yeah.
Okay. So I picked more action-driven ones because language isn't that big of a deal. There is something wonky about nudity. But it's more that I don't want to be sitting next to him and watch something with nudity.
Right.
And violence, like, so in the Die Hard movies, as an example, I showed him Part 2, and Part 2 has so much language and it's really violent. Like it's squibs, and obviously he knows it's not real, but even he turns to me at one point and he's like, I don't even think I should be watching this. I was like, you're probably right. Like, it is pretty intense, but he
called out your parenting.
He did. Yeah. And he's a responsible kid. But he's 16, and it's funny, like, Michelle and I are watching Leftovers. We finished the Leftovers. And Leftovers is not a sexual show, but there's a lot of nudity in it.
Yeah.
And we watch a ton of stuff on the downstairs TV now because the boys are just up in their rooms. They're to the point where they don't need us anymore, and they're out of the way. But PJ has come down and, like, sat on the couch and, like, picked up pieces of Leftovers without watching any of the real episodes. But he's kind of intrigued. Like, he wants to know where everybody disappeared to, and he wants to know what the guilty remnant is. And I'm going way off track, but the point being, we get to a point where Carrie Coon is going to go into this thing at the end of the season, and she disrobes, and Michelle and I were so riveted, and then we were like, oh, wait, PJ, don't, and he goes, and he was literally like, oh, I don't care, I just want to know what happens, like, and I was like, oh, wow, that's weird, you know, like, if we didn't make a big deal about it, he would have just kept watching, and it wouldn't have been a big deal. So,
for some reason, that was always an uncomfortable thing. I remember my dad taking us to see The Rock, And I remember him walking up to the booth at AMC Patrick Henry in Newport News. This is 96.
Was there like one sex scene in that?
Yeah.
And early on, too.
He pulls the manager aside. He buys two adults and two tickets and two kids tickets for The Rock. And I'm like so excited because this was back in the day when I would see a trailer on TV and I would beg my parents to take me to see it. That's like I just missed that. So my dad pulls the manager aside and I don't get to hear what he's asking. And I asked my mom later on. He was asking if there was any sex in the movie because he wanted to cover our eyes if anything happened. So the sex scene in The Rock is like not even bad. It's like it's right before
fully
he gets
clothed.
He gets the phone
outdoors.
Call. It's like a religious moment, right? Aren't they doing it to consummate before they get married? It was like a religious thing for her side of the wedding, I think.
Maybe it's still sex. They're still having
either
sex.
Way. But so I'll never forget my dad and mom and I all sitting there, and of course we had to cover our eyes. But I could watch people get blown to bits and like F bombs all over
he
the
shoves,
place.
Like a little green ball in the dude's mouth, and his mouth is foaming.
I'm like fist pumping. I'm like, heck yeah. And then close my eyes. The same thing. I'll never understand it, but you're a parent and you clearly have that same weirdness as well.
It's a weird, very natural feeling of just like, I don't know how to explain it, but it is really weird.
Anyways, There Will Be Blood won the poll.
Yes. It's a very long way of saying.
Thank you for that tangent.
You guys like There Will Be Blood more than anything else. We are still maintaining our interviews whenever possible, and we've been lucky enough to get some great guests on
whenever
the
possible. We've been interviewing more people now than we have been the history of the show.
Can we say who we've talked to real quick? Alicia Silverstone, Michael Shannon, who you're about to hear, Barry Sonnenfeld's available on a bonus episode right now. We talked to him for an hour. We got some big ones coming up, which we won't say because hashtag if it happens.
Oh, Joey Pantoliano, that happened. We have Joey Pants. We're talking Matrix and Bad Boys.
My TV bosses are going, so you got any of them celebrity interviews? I'm like, well, my podcast does.
Yes, we're lining them up. So this one is Michael Shannon, who was nice enough to join us from his home. He's promoting a film that was supposed to be going to South by Southwest. This is part of the initiative that we launched a while ago to give some more of a spotlight to the films that were going to Austin and were not able to get there. This one got picked up by Lionsgate and is going to their VOD. It's called The Quarry. And so we sat down with Shannon to talk to him about that film and some other really big films in his career. So without further ado, the Real Blend interview with Michael Shannon.
First of all, thank you, Michael, for joining the Real Blend podcast. This is an absolute honor to have you on the show. We know that this film was specifically going to premiere at South by Southwest, and obviously with the festival being canceled and everything happening right now with the pandemic, the film was not able to have its premiere there. I was just curious, for you as somebody who's worked on so many projects over your career, whether they be smaller budget films or larger budget films, you understand the importance of what a festival can bring to a movie or a premiere at a festival. Can you talk about what that was like in regard to have a film that was canceled at the festival and what a festival can do for a movie? What signal boost it gives a film?
Well, first and foremost, I just felt real bad for the festival itself and the city of Austin. I know that was a real crushing blow for them to lose that. I'm sure it's a huge economic boon for the town and also a big part of their identity, you know. So I really, my heart goes out to them. But we felt so grateful to be invited into the festival in the first place. And we felt like it was the perfect festival for the film, the perfect place for it to premiere. So it was a blow, but you have to put everything in perspective. And I honestly think that as much as I wish that we were getting a theatrical release, I think this is a great time for the film to come out, and it's great to be able to offer people something new to take their minds off what's going on for a couple hours. But who knows? We could get lost in the shuffle. I know I haven't personally been watching a lot of movies. I find it hard to concentrate right now. But yeah, we were really looking forward to South By for sure.
Michael, you've obviously worked with Shea Whigham before in both Take Shelter and Boardwalk Empire. And a lot of times when you hear of an actor having worked with a director multiple times, they start talking about having kind of this common language and they understand each other. But I'm curious, as actors, when you have two actors who've worked together a lot, do you develop, like, do you sort of know what to expect coming in when you work with the same actor, or is it still different every time? Because technically you guys are playing different characters under every different circumstance.
Yeah, you know, I'd say first and foremost, we're friends, you know, and we appreciate each other. But it is true that ideally, every time you engage in this practice, you're doing something surprising to yourself and to other people. So I think what's valuable about it is that we really care about each other and we look out for each other and we can talk to each other pretty honestly. There's not a lot of barriers. So even if you want to come and say, you know, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? In certain examples, there can be ego involved, or it doesn't feel appropriate to talk to someone that way. But, you know, we can say pretty much anything to each other. You know, Shay's just a real good listener, a great listener, and an observer of people. And I think that's something we have in common. We're just fascinated by people and what they do.
Michael, I got to admit that while I was watching The Quarry, the only thing I could really think about was, because Shay's character has to assume someone else's identity and essentially pull off being this other person when he goes into the small town, it just reminded me so much of what actors do. And I was thinking the entire time of if you and Shay, as being extremely gifted actors, were to try to go into a small town, assume someone else's identity, because that is essentially your skill set, how far do you think you could possibly get by trying to pull it off and be someone else and assume a different identity?
Oh, my God. I would get scared. I don't know. I don't think I got what it takes. I mean, yeah, you would think if you're smart, as an actor, you just go into be a con artist, right? But I think the con artist probably got something on us. I don't know. I mean, the stakes for us, I mean, I don't want to say they're low. I mean, you don't want to stink and you want to make sure that someone calls you for a job again. But the stakes for them are so much higher. The stakes for the man in this movie are so high. It's one of the things that makes it so compelling, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Michael, you've worked with some of the greatest directors in the history of movies, and I've always wanted to talk to you about other filmmakers you're excited to work with, because I can't wait to see your style of acting blend together with certain filmmakers. I love what you do from a personal level, because even when you do smaller budget films to larger budget films, you still bring 100%, and I always feel for your characters, even in something like A Man of Steel, which is one of my favorite superhero movies ever. I thought you were brilliant as Zod. I genuinely love that movie. And I've always wanted to ask you this, and I know it might be a little off topic, but I am always wanted to ask you this question because that's something I've always wanted to know. As an actor, you make choices for the character, but you're also directed by a director as to what those choices can be as well. And that's the relationship with an actor and a director. At the end of Man of Steel, killing Zod, that was a big deal for Superman fans, because Superman really wasn't a murderer or a killer. And I was always just curious from your perspective what you thought of that, because I know there was a lot of divisiveness and people were, you know, Snyder shouldn't have killed Zod, Superman wouldn't do that. But I loved that ending and I thought it was the necessary ending. What were your personal thoughts on how he ended it? And did you ever go to him with other ideas?
No, I didn't think there was any other way to end it, really. I mean, Zod says it's either me or you. I'm not going to let you survive. I will kill you unless you kill me. Hmm. And that seemed sufficiently, you know, Greek to me, you know? I mean, it was so amazing to me shooting that scene, because I'm from Chicago, or I started acting in Chicago anyway, and I was there in Union Station, which is like an iconic building in Chicago, in the same place they shot the stroller scene from The Untouchables.
Yeah.
I just kept looking around trying to figure out where where was Andy Garcia? Where was Sean Connery? Where was Kevin Costner? You know, where were they all standing? So that was my main preoccupation when I was shooting that scene. But I've seen other actors that feel more comfortable kind of going in, screwing around with the script and the story. But I've never felt real comfortable with that unless there's something that's just glaringly nonsensical. I kind of keep my mouth shut because I'm not a writer. I couldn't write a screenplay to save my life. So I have a lot of respect for the script, and I only go off it if I'm encouraged to by the director.
You know, Michael, speaking of Chicago, I know you can't see me right now. I'm having some video issues, but I'm actually a reporter here in Chicago, and I've spoken to you here in Chicago many times. And, you know, one of my favorite stories, and I think one of Chicago's favorite entertainment stories of the past few years, was the night of the Oscars, the night that The Shape of Water won Best Picture. You weren't there, obviously. You were sort of at a famous spot here in town, and there's that picture of you actually watching it win Best Picture. And one of the things that really struck me about that is that you've never really sort of followed this trajectory that Hollywood says, okay, if you're going to be an actor and you're going to star in big movies that win awards, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And you've never really done that. I'm sort of curious, like, was it a conscious choice early in your career to say, you know what, I'm just in it for the craft. I don't really care about that aspect of it. Or was there a particular reason that you didn't want to go that night?
Yeah. Well, you know, the owner of the Ale House took that photo, Bruce, or one of the owners. I guess his ex-wife really is the owner. But anyway, he took the picture and he said, you have no idea what this is going to do. And I said, what are you talking about, Bruce? Who's going to care about that silly picture? And here I am. I was in town, honestly, because a show that I had directed was closing. And I had been gone because I had been working on Little Drummer Girl. And I had missed most of the run. And my cast, you know, this play ran through the winter in Chicago. And it was a brutal winter. And, you know, people were getting sick. People were slipping on ice. I mean, my cast had just gone through hell to do the show. And it was a very popular show for the theater. And I felt like I owed it to them to be there for the closing, which was in the afternoon. It was a matinee. So I went to the last performance and then we had a reception afterwards. And I told everybody how much I appreciated the hard work they had done. And then we had a little after party at the Ale House. And but don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm phenomenally proud of the fact that I'm in The Shape of Water, and I'm phenomenally proud of the fact that I worked with Guillermo, and I don't take it lightly, not one bit, but I'm also very proud of the work I do in Chicago at my little theater company. So I did, and I felt like I owed it to my people to be there.
Cool. Michael, we've been lucky enough to talk to a lot of different people on this podcast as they're working through this global pandemic and being in such an unusual situation. We spoke to a lot of writers and directors, and they're talking about how they've been able to stay busy working on scripts. But I never really know, like with actors, what you guys are doing in order to pass the time while you're in quarantine. And also, I'm just curious about the fact that when we're out of this, when things return to normal, sort of business as usual, the types of stories that you're going to be interested in telling, if you'll look for material that is rooted in this really contemporary and unusual situation, or as a storyteller yourself, if you'd look for something that's so completely different, like a screwball comedy or some type of a sci-fi fiction type thing that takes you completely out of this moment. I'm just curious, because you've touched on a lot of different subject materials over the years, what type of thing you'll want to look for when you're back to acting.
You know, it's funny you bring this up because somebody, I was talking to somebody the other day and they were talking about Take Shelter and how relevant it is right now. And I said, I appreciate that, but I felt like Take Shelter was relevant when I was making it. I mean, I feel like Take Shelter is relevant all the time. I realize that we're all feeling very fragile and vulnerable right now, but I'm always keenly aware, or I don't mean to sound like an arrogant ass, but I, I seem to be keenly aware of just how fragile and vulnerable we are all the time. This virus is not like a surprise to me, and it's not a surprise to a lot of very educated people. I'm not one of them, but I'm just saying they're confirming my darker fears and anxieties about life. So, and a lot of the work that I've done, Take Shelter and otherwise, has been fueled by that. So, you know, it's funny, a lot of people have been trying to encourage to generate content online, like, oh, do a show online or something. I don't really want to do that. I don't, something about that feels, and I'm not poo-pooing on anybody who is doing it. God bless you. Godspeed. Have fun. But to me, it seems a little disrespectful of the experience. I mean, I do think we needed to be put in a position where we genuinely understand how powerless we are and how fortunate we are to live on a planet that will facilitate our existence and how close we are to losing that. So I don't mind like not doing my little shows for a little while and letting that really sink in.
That being said, Michael, I really do hope that you get back to it really soon.
You're funny.
You know, I was telling you, Michael, that you've worked with so many amazing filmmakers over your career. I'm weird. I love you in Bad Boys 2. I just love all the random things you've done because you're in so many different movies. I was curious what your experience was like working with someone like a Michael Bay, but also, are there filmmakers that you can't wait to work with? Are there ones that like are on your bucket list? And I'm sure you're not going to like actively reach out to them and go, can I please work with you? But like, who would be like a dream? And was Bay fun?
I have to say it was an extraordinary experience working with him. I definitely have some of the most interesting stories, you know, because people always want stories and I'm not a good story guy. Like I don't have a lot of anecdotes. Except about working with him, you know, he was a story. He was a story factory. He just do something every day that just blow your mind. I mean, that was more honestly, that was more on Pearl Harbor than on Bad Boys 2. He kind of receded into the background a little bit more on Bad Boys 2. I think just because Will and Martin are such gigantic personalities. On Pearl Harbor, he was working with a bunch of little dipshits who were just lucky to be there so he could be really full throttle, you know. But, you know, I've said from time to time over the years how much I've wanted to work with David Lynch, but I don't really think that's ever going to happen.
What's your favorite Lynch movie?
Oh, boy. That's tough.
Is it weird changes. That I'm an Elephant Man or Blue Velvet? I love those are my two favorites.
Yeah, no, those. I mean, I love. In a way, I'd have to say Eraserhead's my favorite, even though I don't mean to discount his. He's obviously done a lot of amazing work since then. I mean, Mulholland Drive, probably. Yeah. But there's something about all of them that I love. I mean, I'll sit and watch Inland Empire. Some people are like, I can't make it. I'm like, oh, too bad. I like it. You know, I was just about to start working with David O. Russell, which I was really curious about. But then the virus struck. So I'm hoping to get to that when we're back up and going. But I've gotten to work with a lot of really great people. I'm really lucky. I'd like to work with Paul Thomas Anderson, but who wouldn't?
Yes. Oh my God. I'm sure you love Phantom Thread. Phantom Thread in 70mm is one of my favorite movie theater experiences ever.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like working with young folks. I still like, you know, I mean, I should kind of be careful when I say that. It's not like, you know, they're not always going to be Jeff Nichols, you know, but that's the most exciting experience of my career up to this point is having found Jeff and having worked with him from the ground up.
Yeah, Midnight Special is a masterpiece.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
It just
thank
is,
you.
Man.
Yeah. Thank you.
I know we have to let you go, but did you say earlier that the Quarry actually has a release date? Did it get picked up for distribution?
Yeah, Lionsgate picked it up before the festival, and they're releasing it. And, you know, I appreciate it as much as I do want it to play in a theater someday. You know, there's certain movies, you keep hearing all these stories about movies pushing, and I get it, but it is nice to give people something new. You know, you shouldn't punish the people. It's not their fault, you know. Give them something to, yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on the Real Blend podcast, man. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, and we'll let everybody know about the Quarry, how they can check it out, and stay up to date with everything that you're doing as we get through this.
Yeah, no worries.
Great seeing you, Michael.
You too.
We want to thank Michael Shannon for joining us from his home. It's still unusual to get these celebrities during this time because they're trying to figure it out. We're trying to figure it out. Yes, Kevin.
I noticed in the edit that Gabe did for Michael Shannon, he left out a very important and pivotal question that I just don't know why he left it out. So can we tell our audience what it was?
Sure. I guess so. Yeah, I'll leave it to you because I'm not sure where this is going, but yeah.
Michael Shannon, he revealed to us his favorite director. Do you remember this?
No, I don't. Maybe I logged off the call because there was a point where we all logged off and you were still on with Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
Just talking to each other.
Yeah. So
what was it?
His answer for his favorite movie of all time was Christopher the McQuarrie.
Oh.
Thank you.
I'm so glad we have video.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Come on, the quarry. It's perfect.
No,
it's literally perfect.
I get it. No, I get it.
Why did that one get crickets? That one got really bad crickets. Why?
It really deserved it. We have news to get to.
We have
some really exciting. Yeah, we have really exciting news to get to. Oh, no, I mean news. Like in the world of movie entertainment.
So
here
he
we
said.
Go. Dune is dropping a ton of images, and if I'm being totally candid, I don't really get what the excitement is yet. Yet, I mean, it's Denis, and he's doing Dune, and that's great. But Jake, I need you to tell me. Why these images, beyond the fact that it's just this amazing cast, they're just wearing spacesuits. It's fine, but like, I didn't look at them and be like, whoa, reinvention of cinema. What am I missing out
that,
on?
That logo on your shirt is just a picture of an imaginary movie that doesn't exist.
Well, yes, no, I know, but I mean, I'm looking at the images. What are they? What's important about them?
I just think everything sort of, it's making me look at... Because when you read a book, you have a vision in your mind, right? And in a certain way, it's kind of been construed by the 80s film, which like that. And then I was a really big fan of the Sci-Fi Channel. They did like that 4-part miniseries. So that's kind of whenever I was reading, like that's sort of what I had in my mind.
Yeah.
And then Denis put out these images and I go, oh, that's exactly it. To me, it perfectly fit in my mind what Frank Herbert would have wanted.
Okay.
Like it almost corrected all the images in my mind made me go, oh, that's 100%.
Did you see Frank Herbert's son, what he said?
No, what did he say?
Oh, I'll continue, Jake, and I'll pull it up and read it.
Well, basically, you know, the downside of reading a book ahead of a movie is that the movie in no way compares to the images that you contrived in your head. And then whenever I saw those images, I just went, oh, that just looks so much cooler than. And granted, it's a lot of more like the character pieces. And maybe it's just that I'm excited because... A lot of times the danger of casting these big names like, you know, Timothy and Zendaya and Josh Brolin and Oscar Isaac is that you're seeing them in these big movies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I looked at these pictures and then instantly forgot. I'm like, oh, it's, you know, it's Paul Atreides. You know, it's all the, you know. So I think it excited me that just in a matter of frames, they were able to overcome celebrity and capture what I think Frank Herbert intended.
So this is Frank Herbert's son about those
exact
images.
Who went on to write several Dune novels after his dad died.
So this is Brian Herbert. This is a tweet. Quote, Dune fans, I hope you're all as excited as I am to see these early glimpses of the new Dune movie. My father would be incredibly proud.
Okay. Isn't that the biggest, like, really that's the biggest cosign?
So the cast is incredible. And that's what I kind of took away. Like, every new photo that dropped was just another name that I was like, oh, I forgot they're in this. Oh my God, I forgot they're in this. It's obviously Timothée Chalamet is playing Paul, the main character. Zendaya, you mentioned. Rebecca Ferguson is in it. Oscar Isaac, who we got a picture of. Jason Momoa. Stellan Skarsgård. Dave Bautista. Josh Brolin. Javier Bardem. Charlotte Rampling. So, I mean, the cast is off the charts.
Skarsgård?
Right? Yeah. I said him. And then they confirmed.
Christian Bale playing the Sandworm.
The Sandworm, putting on all those pounds to play the
45,000 pounds.
Is the Sandworm a legitimate thing? Like, is that a big sequence?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's going to be.
All right. So it's funny. Jake and I started reading Dune at the same time, and then I stopped reading it, and Jake powered through. I do need to circle back around to it. Gabe, I will mention, he doesn't speak, but is a huge fan of Dune. It is his most anticipated film of the year. And so we're starting to see photos, which could mean trailer. Maybe a trailer coming up soon?
Well, those images were, I'm as excited as Jake is. I have not read Dune, but I think a lot of it has to do with who's working on it. Denis specifically, and obviously Greg Fraser, the DP. I'm just super interested to see what they're going to do with this. I know mm-hmm. that Lynch's movie in the 80s was not well received. And I know that, you know, what Denis is doing now that we know this is doing two Dune films, right? So the first half of Dune is going to come out in December. And I'm right. genuinely excited to see where that goes. Now, the interesting thing about what Jake just said about not seeing actors and seeing characters, I felt the same way. I mean, you watch Blade Runner 2049. I'm seeing I'm not seeing Gosling. I'm seeing the character. I'm seeing I'm seeing Ford's character. I think that Denis. It's so funny. As I've been sitting home a lot, I've been rewatching a lot of films and focusing on these films from more of a story perspective than a technical perspective, because I'm a big technical fan and I love watching films from a filmmaking standpoint. But I've been learning a lot about story as I've been home. Like, I rewatched The Matrix last night, and I'll take this back to Dune, but I'll tell you why what I mean. With The Matrix, every action scene, while cool, is designed to push the story forward. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when Neo's dodging bullets, that's a cool sequence. But think about what that scene is telling you. It's telling you, it's inching you towards him being the one, right? Mm-hmm. It's a massive arc for the character. It is a cool scene, but at the end of the day, it is a story point that moves him forward.
For sure.
And I think that Denis is so good at world building and story. You know, Sicario had some incredible shots, as did Prisoners. But when you think about Denis' work, aside from Blade Runner, which I think was probably his most visual pleasing film, I feel that he is such a great storyteller. Arrival, when I look back on Arrival, I think of the emotion, not the visual aspect of it. It's all into one thing.
I don't know, dude. The circles and the way they communicated and everything.
Don't get me wrong. The visuals for Arrival are incredible. I guess the point I'm making is there are times where style becomes more important than substance. And I think in this particular case with someone like Denis, what I'm interested in Dune is the story and the characters. I think he's going to handle the characters really well. And then everything else is just going to play into it. Deakins' cinematography in Blade Runner plays into that storyline. It's gorgeous, but it also plays into the story. So I think what makes me excited about Dune specifically is Denis. And I think that he is going to build these worlds and make us care. And it's going to look amazing, but it's actually going to mean something. And that's what I'm excited about.
Also, it's just going to be fun. Like, Denis' films are just fun.
Prisoners?
I mean, just laugh a minute. You know, you just strap in and just
feel good for the whole belly
family. Laugh. Yeah.
Enemies? Okay, explain the context of that joke to people that don't follow you on Twitter.
But I'm not gonna harp on it because it's too much. But there was just like a film Twitter joke about the first shot of Timothée Chalamet. And they were like, oh, good. I was afraid that Dune was going to be fun. And that joke doesn't work for two main reasons. A, it shows a total lack of awareness for what Dune is as a source material. And B, it for someone who claims that they're in film Twitter, which is disgusting as it is, shows a total lack of awareness for the type of... No, I don't think you are either. It shows a lack of awareness of the type of movie that Denis delivers. Like, he just doesn't... Yeah. He's not a popcorn blockbuster guy, you know? Well, he's intelligent, and he explores the gray areas, and... He's a visual master, and that's what he does. So
this gets into a very interesting discussion and that we are having yesterday that I find interesting. Will Dune be financially successful? And it's an interesting perspective because you have two parts of this film coming out. And we were discussing yesterday that Chalamet's big in certain circles, but is he big enough to carry a film like this? And it's interesting. Like, I think Chalamet might be at the perfect point in his career where he's not too famous, where this will work. And maybe this will be the launch. I do wonder, though, Blade Runner 2049 didn't make a ton of money for what it costs, right? So Blade Runner is Dune's a gigantic budget. So if the first half doesn't do well, what happens, right? We were discussing this yesterday.
Whether they commit to finishing it or not. I think they have to commit
to finishing it. Or is he done with it? I think he shot everything.
Did they shoot it all at one time and split it in the middle?
I think he shot everything. I bet you Denis shot the entire film and he's just splitting it into two. I don't know.
Do you think it's going to be 2 3-hour films or 2 2-hour films?
Probably 2:45 each. That's my guess. Was 49 was
2:40. Because also keep in mind, even though it was planned to be three films, Jackson was still shooting Lord of the Rings by the time Fellowship came out. Like, they were still over there working on it.
Well, that's an interesting one, but I also don't... Do you think Denis knew he was making two movies when he was shooting Dune? Or did he decide on it later?
It sounds like he said he wasn't going to take it unless they let him tell it over multiple chapters.
It doesn't sound like a Kill Bill situation, not to start a fight, but it doesn't sound like a situation where the studio is saying, hey, you got to split this.
Heard what happened is that he really wanted to make his favorite Johnny Depp movie. He was going to remake his favorite Johnny Depp movie.
Ooh. Hold on a second.
And it fell through, so he ended up just taking this on instead, which is weird because he wasn't very passionate about it. He really was passionate about doing his favorite Johnny Depp movie.
So Denis wants to remake his favorite Johnny Depp movie.
He wanted to, but then he couldn't get the rights to it. It's called... Benny and Dune.
That's good.
So a story broke.
Charity laugh. See?
Thank you. Story broke earlier this week that Trolls, which circumvented the theatrical release and is one of the only films to do this, although Disney now has Artemis Fowl going to their Disney Plus series, Trolls World Tour is claiming that it is the best VOD release of all time. And they cited no real numbers to back it up. So we're a little bit skeptical. And Jake in particular, who likes to be the journalist on the show.
Honestly, please correct me, Kevin. It shocks me that you're skeptical of this, yet you were always so accepting of Netflix's numbers. You're skeptical. I mean, I'm skeptical of everything because I don't believe anybody. But what is the difference between this and Netflix numbers?
Great question, Jake Hamilton.
Those are the ones I ask.
There are two completely different sides of the story. So Netflix, when they release their numbers, they say 34 million people watched.
I feel like I just opened Pandora's box.
No. This is actually a very interesting discussion. So Netflix, when they release their numbers, 34 million people watched Tiger King in the first 10 days. Okay, that's a statement they put out. So the reason Jake was being skeptical about that, and we had a whole argument on our show on some earlier episodes, was what does that number mean? Did they actually watch all of it? Did they hit play for 1 minute and turn it off? We don't know the measuring of that. I know Nielsen obviously is involved now with their ratings, and a lot has changed since then. That's a completely different situation that I'm referring to with this case. It's funny because I feel like in this case, there's nothing to compare it to. So there's no movie that has ever dropped on VOD that I know of, a major theatrical film that dropped on VOD instead of going to theaters.
Sure.
So think about this.
In the middle of a pandemic when we're all in isolation.
Exactly. So, but also
think about... Yeah, but like, if you're number one, you're number one. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. Like, if you're in a situation where you were able to do it, why not climb? I mean, honestly, like, Kevin Smith does that all the time. When he does his, like, two movies...
Per theater. I know.
Per theater, and that's how he's in the top 10. Like, you take advantage of the circumstances and work the statistics in your favor.
But here's the point I'm making. So... The article headline of saying it had the biggest VOD purchases ever, that is true. It's not that I'm not disputing that. I'm saying it's wrong to make it seem like it's special, and I'll tell you why. Because if you put Black Widow out or No Time to Die on VOD tomorrow, those numbers would blow away Trolls. So my point is, when Trolls is the first to do it, Yeah. There's nothing to compare it to.
Oh, yeah, so I see what you're saying.
So, for example, there's no other major film that I can think of.
But they're not the first to do it. They're just the first to have these favorable circumstances.
No.
They're not the first VOD movie. No,
that's not what I'm saying.
VOD. I know what Kevin's saying. A movie that was supposed to go to theaters that went to VOD instead.
So think about it this way, Jake.
It's circumstances in its favor, but it's still a VOD release.
Let me finish this one part. So Bad Boys for Life comes out on VOD, right?
Right.
That already had a theatrical run where they made over $370 million, whatever it was. Okay. My point is, by the time it gets to VOD, a lot of people who wanted to see it have already seen it. So the numbers when it hits the VOD aren't going to spike like Trolls did because nobody has seen Trolls.
I get your point, but I don't understand why you're faulting a studio for...
No, I'm not faulting the studio.
I get your point, like, because no other VOD release has ever had these particular set of circumstances to take advantage of, but like, why not take that and then spout the numbers out? Like, why not?
Here's the point. Universal is not wrong, and if I was the company, I would do the exact same thing. It is a completely accurate statistic. My point is that it should be taken with a grain of salt because it does not actually indicate that Trolls is some gigantic film that broke massive records because of how popular it is. My point about this is if any other film hit VOD like Trolls did, Bond, Widow, all these films, the numbers would be so astronomical compared to what Trolls got downloaded. So my point is, yes, I'm not calling Universal out. They are accurate in reporting it, and rightfully so. My point is the headline is misleading. It is
but
not
you're
really
also the guy who is clamoring for movie theaters to open for Christopher Nolan so that Tenet could have the biggest box office opening of all time. That's kind of what you've been saying for the last 4 weeks.
I never said that. You're taking box office into account. My thoughts on Tenet and the record and tape will show. I said it would be amazing if Tenet came out and was the movie that reopened film and cinemas. I never say anything about it being the biggest box office opening of all time. I'm just saying that statistic is accurate, but misleading in my personal opinion.
But aren't box office statistics the same thing? We don't take inflation into account every time we report the biggest box office weekend of all time. Like,
Sean, am I crazy?
It's the circumstances. It's the circumstances in which like they are released. Like no one said Avengers Endgame is the highest grossing film of all time, except not really, because really it's Gone with the Wind. Like you kind of just roll. Like
I just think we're 4 minutes longer on Trolls than I ever wanted to be.
No, but this is an interesting
in the history
discussion
of this show.
We feel weird that I'm on this side of the argument because usually I'm the one that's like, no, screw the studios for putting out those numbers. But like you can't criticize one and not criticize the other.
I have nothing against Universal. I'm talking about that headline itself is not really the way it seems.
Yeah.
That's I'm saying.
Then is Avengers Endgame really the highest grossing film of all time?
Yes.
Technically it is. Yes.
Yes.
Well then technically Trolls is the biggest VOD opening of all time.
You're thinking so much about logistics and details. I'm telling you that the headline itself does not tell the full truth.
All right, let's get on to a ray of hope that we might be able to foster Kevin's belief that Tenet may save us all. Right before we started to record, Cinemark, not one of the major chains, but one of the mid-tier chains, announced a plan to essentially reopen their outlets in July. And July 1st is the date that they gave them. And they said it's not going to be a all of our business, you know, flip the switch and here we go type thing. They described it more as a toe in the water. And they used as a plan in the story I read on Deadline, factors that we've been talking about on this show, which is they would open with a all-star lineup from their library the first 2 weeks to get people back into theaters slowly and to get them used to being open and operating with crowds. And there's probably going to be even some more stipulations in place about where you can sit and how they're going to control the seating and some of the other factors that we brought up on other episodes of the show in terms of maybe if each house is at half capacity, you put more theaters or more movies on more screens so that you can get close to the capacity numbers that you would be programming, because especially they're not going to get to a point where we have a lot of movies competing against each other, a lot of new releases right off the bat, because the slate would be slow to go. But they said If they opened on July 1st, it would allow them to do a few weeks of retrospective programming and then be ready for Tenet on July 17th. And I knew that there was one boy in Washington, D.C. who was so happy to hear that Cinemark is preparing for the opening of Christopher Nolan's Tenet.
Of course they are.
I will throw it to Jake for starters, though, and say, Jake, is this realistic to you?
I don't, because movie theaters do not set the timeline. Like a business cannot come forward and say, here's when the world is going to go back to normal. That's not how it works. Like, the businesses are at the mercy of basically, like, the direction that the world is moving in. And I think it is way too premature. Like, there's a reason that government officials right now are not saying, here's when you can go back outside. Because, like, nobody knows. Sure. So for a business to say, here's when our doors are going to reopen and here's when you can come back and start doing normal real life things, it's too premature. Like, I get the hope. And if they were, like, it, like this idea that, like, okay, like, it would be great if, but, like, you can't. And if you want to start planning for it, sure, I guess. But, like, well, you don't set the timeline.
That's exactly it, though. I think they have to have a plan in place.
Yep.
I think they have to have a date circled that they realistically would like to get to, and to start to see how the numbers trend, obviously. So that way, if we get close to middle of June and things are winding down, or we have a better handle on it than we do at the moment, your plan is implemented. And it's funny, I watch a lot of sports talk and things on ESPN, and I watch PTI, the Pardon the Interruption, all the time. And they were having this very exact debate where one guy was totally into the idea of baseball having a plan, which is something we were talking about in our text thread. And the other guy saying it's too soon to even have this discussion. But I fall into the camp of, it's smart to have a plan. You know, it's smart to have yes, we're going to need a couple of weeks to ramp up. But right now, the first movie that has a release date is still Nolan and Warner Brothers. Everybody else has sort of moved beyond that. Even SpongeBob, which was going to be in that July, late July, has moved into August 7th now. Mulan is still the end of July. But it's starting to feel like it's solidifying. Now, Jake, I know you say that the business can't control it, but I brought up something on the show the other day and it was kind of scoffed at, but then these guys said it in their story. They're losing so much money that they may just have to open, you know, for people who want to come so that they're making something, you know, let alone, versus, you know,
but
staying
if
closed.
Major cities are outlawing or forbidding, whatever the word is you want to use, gatherings of 10 or more people, then how can you do that? Like a restaurant.
Hey Jake, you're
in
assuming
Chicago
that's
going right to
be the case in 3 months.
I'm not saying it's not going to. I don't know. I don't know.
It's three hard months, because the situation changes week to week. It really does.
Yeah.
But
I mean, keep in mind, like, you know, we've seen one country do this before, like literally open up their movie theaters with this exact same plan, and they ended up shutting them down again.
Right. Yeah, true. Kev?
I mean, I mean, this all comes down to everything we've been discussing on the show, which is logic versus realistic mindsets here. I mean, Jake, logically, I think that logically that is probably the right mindset to have. I am just choosing to go the other route with my mind. I want to believe that. And not that you don't, I'm not saying you don't want to believe this, but I'm saying I just want to believe in my head that we will somehow be out of this by the end of May and we all start kind of integrating back into normal life in June. And that makes a July 17th release possible. And right now it's only April, what is it, April 15th or whatever today's date is. We're 3 months out from Tenet's release. So my only thing that I want to say is, and going back to Tenet, I just would love to see Tenet reopen the movie business. I think it's the perfect movie to do it.
I have a question. Because Kevin said that, and we know that for sure. If the movie theaters are allowed to open in time for Tenet, but not in New York and L.A.
Mm.
They do not open Tenet. You do not open drop... Tenet? You know, they do not. You do not drop a $200 million Christopher Nolan movie without every possible person in the country, every possible person in the world being able to see it.
Also,
LA, markets one and two, no.
Also, no, LA is where Nolan lives and where Nolan works on his movies. He tests his dailies at the AMC University City Walk, Universal City Walk, which is the best theater ever. If you ever go there, sit in K16. It's amazing. 8-story IMAX screen. But I don't know. I it's an interesting point, Sean. I just, I, part of me, I just
because I, I'm with I you. It feels like like a large portion might be able to be open, but right? you might not have two of the biggest cities in our country. But that's the thing too,
they've talked about staggering these things. And then again, that not just staggering the country, but staggering the things that people will be able to go out and do. Yeah. And unfortunately, the article that Kevin sent us yesterday that from New York Times Magazine, where Zeke Emanuel, who is a bioethicist and an oncologist, basically said that, like, yes, we are going to stagger the events that people, the things that people are able to go out and do. But unfortunately, the realm of entertainment, and within that realm, we're talking concerts and sporting events and, yes, movies, is going to be, unfortunately, very, very low, if not dead last, in the list of priorities to get up and running again.
According to that same article, though, that would mean movie theaters aren't going to open for 18 months, like fall of 2021.
I think that's a little probably, extreme. I think that's extreme. But then again, I also think that a movie like Tenet needs to have a guaranteed maximum possible audience. And July, I'm not saying it would have no audience, but a maximum audience, and you're not going to have a maximum audience by
Jake,
July.
It could be on every screen.
Yeah.
What if Tenet? In a 24 screen.
Yeah. Tenet is that movie.
There's no competition.
On 717, Nolan reopens. I mean, again, I know Jake talks about the idea of rolling things out. Maybe cinemas reopen a little, like a week or two early. But imagine Nolan going,
I stand by. Let's make a bet.
Come back.
What could be the bet?
I don't know. Let's think about it. But like, I'm standing by my stance. You're standing by your stance. Let's make a bet.
All right. Let's think about it. We'll come back around. Yeah. All right. So one other aspect of our industry that is grappling with these delays is the Cannes Film Festival. Officially, it was announced that it is not happening in June as it normally would, but it's going to be looking elsewhere in 2020. Still holding out the hope that a semblance of the Cannes Film Festival can be held. The Cannes chief, Thierry Frémaux, reveals that there have been ongoing discussions with the Venice Film Festival artistic director about doing something together if the Cannes Film Festival is canceled, while other festivals have also reached out to discuss partnerships. That is per Variety. Now, at the moment, San Diego Comic-Con has not canceled yet either, but that feels wildly optimistic because I just don't see that many groups of people coming back together. But I have spoken to studio representatives who talked about Comic-Con specifically, saying from their perspective, they feel like they really need it. Like, they need an event that would allow them to promote the movies that they have coming. But again, that sort of gets back to, you need that certainty in place. You know, they're going to have a place to screen those movies. But I've heard from multiple studios that they would not be opposed to still holding on to Comic-Con because they just need a big event that allows them to talk about some of the films that are coming. So I don't know. I mean, the three of us tend to look at something like Toronto. It's one that we go to and cover on a regular basis. Let me ask you guys this right now. How comfortable would you even feel about going to Toronto in September?
I don't think
personally.
We're not going to Toronto in September. I don't think we're leaving the country for a while.
Really?
Personally. I mean, I have no idea, but I can't imagine international travel being a thing.
If they said you could, how would you feel about it?
I'd go.
Would you?
100%.
I feel like I'd go to like a Toronto. For some reason, I'm uncomfortable about going to like London.
Oh, well, London, that's out of the question. We won't. I don't think we're going back to London for a long time.
For a long time?
You know what's weird? I would be okay going to Toronto. I'm not sure how comfortable I'd be going to Comic-Con.
Okay, because too many people?
Just because it's a large group of people. Like,
Comic-Con's not happening.
The most like cliche, this is a horrible cliche, but like not like always the most hygienic people in the world, I guess?
Okay, no, come on now. I'm joking. My people there. Just reminds me of, there was a time when we went, we were at the water park here in Charlotte, Carowinds. And there's a area of the water park that my family, for whatever reason, loves. It's the big wave pool. It's a huge pool. And every 5 to 10 minutes, they start up waves in huge groups. But it's like a person's stew. It's like a stew of bodies. And I don't know why my family likes it. And Michelle's always saying, like, come on in. So I get in with all my weird OCDs. And there was this one time where I went up on a wave and I came down on some guy's hairy back, and his hairy back, like literally my face, like
it's a long cane, Polly.
Is that what happened in Along Came Polly?
Oh my God, he's playing basketball and that guy's hair goes into Ben Stiller's mouth and he's like dripping sweat out of his mouth.
And his face like slides along.
That happened to me in a wave pool. Yeah. Yes. And that wave pool, not unlike San Diego Comic-Con on its best day. So that's the visual.
That was a joke. I did not mean to insult anyone that goes to San Diego Comic-Con. Like, don't turn it into a whole thing.
All right, this week in movies, or not at movie theaters, on streaming instead, I want to kick off with Underwater because Kev just saw it. Kev, worth seeing.
I was super interested in this film. So last night, Lauren said we're going to watch Underwater. The production value on this film is insane. It's like a $90 million film. I had no idea it was that big. We're talking practical sets, like sets I haven't seen in films in a long time. This thing was massive. And it was a smaller film that came out in January that I felt like nobody talked about. And I listen, at the end of the day, I think that it has some script issues. I think some of the acting was you know, not up to par with what I would expect from a movie of that size. But I'll tell you right now, if you're into just like a 90-minute intense ride, the whole movie takes place underwater in 36,000 feet on the I think it's in the deepest trench in the world. And it's a pretty horrifying concept. Essentially, an earthquake hits and you see this gigantic platform that they're all working in down below just start getting crushed like grass, like just like, you know what I mean? Like if you stepped on grass, it would just go simply just go down. That's how their structure started happening because the pressure is so brutal down there. So one of the things I wanted to give credit for to the filmmakers was they set up this great thing in the beginning of the movie that always makes you remember that there's water and pressure around you. Even though you're in a building or even though you're inside, there's still that feeling. And I think that's a great thing a director can do at the beginning of a film is set that tone. So I found the film to be engaging. It's extremely intense, very violent. There's a death in this movie, going back to our PG-13 R-rated discussion, that I think is genuinely going to horrify me for years. This is like a PG-13 film. But in this particular scene, I guess I can talk about it, right? It's been out for a while.
Why not?
Sure. Don't ruin it, because I'd actually like to see it.
I won't say who the character is or what happened. I just want to explain the violent aspect of it. It's pretty wicked. There's a guy in a suit. He's wearing his suit so that way he doesn't get crushed by the pressure. So they can go outside and walk. This is not a spoiler.
No, keep going. I just don't want to hear it. Keep going.
Not like
keep
a jacket and tie suit.
It's a big suit. So there's a moment where the character gets stuck and some kind of monster is trying to drag the character back towards the monster and away from his friends or coworkers. And he's dragging him with so much force that the close up on the screen is the helmet and just the face screaming as he's trying to get pulled back towards his friends while this monster's pulling him. You literally see his face disfigure and smush and get pulled through the suit, and the entire thing just turns blood red. But the image of his face going from a normal face to a digital squished side version of it was so terrifying because it all happens in one shot.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how they did it, but it is nasty. Tell me that's not intriguing. Tell me you don't want to watch the movie now.
I do want to see that movie. Yeah. Yes. Now based on that, we should actually do. Did we do like a kills blend? Did we do like a worst kills? I forget.
Kill blend's a good one.
Kill blend's a pretty good one. Yeah. All right. Anyway, Fantasy Island. Jeff Wadlow and Jason Blum. Anybody catch up with Fantasy Island?
No, I just heard it was so bad.
I did too. Yeah, I heard really bad things about it. We did have Reed Morano, the director, on our episode earlier this year talking about The Rhythm Section, which is available on VOD. Blake Lively, Jude Law. I enjoyed that film a lot. I thought Blake Lively did a really good job transitioning over into action role. So make sure you go back and revisit our conversation with her. There's a great, great oner in that movie that stays in the passenger seat with Blake Lively as she tries to escape. If we did, very funny, Gabe, very funny. Wendy is coming to VOD on April 17th. Jake and I are split on this one. It's a Peter Pan retelling. I was totally enchanted by it. Jake has no heart, so he didn't see any reason to.
No, I had a heart the first 74 times I saw this story.
Well, Ben Zeitland came on our show and told me all the reasons why the movie is wonderful, and so I was glad that I did the interview.
A lot of people come on this show and talk about why their movies are wonderful.
They do, yes, very true. Including...
So tell me how good Bloodshot was.
Oof, not very good. It was not very good.
Gabe, is that crossing the line?
Bloodshot was awful.
Movie is Endings Beginnings, which is Drake Dormu. He did a movie a while back called, it had Felicity Jones in it and
Star Wars.
No, he did not do Rogue One, unfortunately. This one has Shailene Woodley. He makes these sort of artsy poetic love story ones, but I'm intrigued to see what Endings Beginnings is. Comes to VOD on 4/17. Finally, coming to Amazon Prime, The Lighthouse, Gabe's favorite movie of all time.
You didn't like me, Lemmy Lobster?
You can revisit Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe talking about the farts and going mad.
And what he would do with a steak.
In a lighthouse together.
I will never forget interviewing Willem Dafoe for some Disney Plus movie, and he was sitting next to his co-star, and I it's like this film about dogs. It was like nothing to do with The Lighthouse. And I had seen The Lighthouse the day before. So my last two films I watched were Lighthouse and then this G-rated dog film he was doing for Disney Plus. They couldn't be more different in thematic. So I get up. I think I've told the story, but I left the room and I turned around. I said, Mr. Dafoe, if you don't mind me asking, were those farts real? And he said, what did he say? He said something along the lines of like, some of them were real and some of them were added, but his response was much funnier than now that I'm thinking about it. So I'm bombing while telling the story, but he did respond to that.
Cool story, bro.
Yeah, cool story. I got nothing else to say except for he said some of them are real. Move on.
Robert Eggers also joined our show to talk about how great The Lighthouse is. So you can go back and find that episode also in our archive. So that brings us to the blend game. And we are playing this week Tony Scott blend in honor of the late, great director of so many fantastic 90s, 2000s, or 80s. I think his career dipped into the 80s too. Yeah, 80s, 90s. Action movie films, a lot of them with Denzel Washington. I realize how often he and Denzel collaborated on films over the years, and we definitely miss Tony's contributions. It's weird that we have a Top Gun movie coming out in Top Gun Maverick. It's not going to be directed by Tony. And when we were, not to name drop, sitting with Quentin Tarantino, he told us that he talked to Tom Cruise and thought it was strange that that Tom Cruise was coming back without Tony Scott. And Tom Cruise told Quentin Tarantino that it was the script that had won him over. And so that's why we're going to see Maverick.
If those two were talking, do you think it was potentially about like ever collaborating?
Well, Cruise was supposed to be in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
So it was probably during all of that. So
yeah, that's right.
We took away the caveat that Kevin couldn't pick True Romance. So let's find out what he went with instead. Because we know True Romance is his favorite film of all time, or one of them at least. Yeah. Is it your favorite of all time?
Yeah, I have two, and I don't mind cheating. It's Terminator 2 and True Romance. Those are right on the same playing field for me. This is an interesting one because my obvious answer is True Romance. I'll take 1 second to tell you if you haven't seen it. It's one of the greatest casts ever. No one saw it in theaters. It bombed. My favorite thing to do is when talking to people about movies is bring that up and they go, what the heck is that? And then you get to tell someone about that movie. That's so special because
do people
it's
not know what, and this isn't a sarcastic question. No. Do people not know what True Romance is?
True Romance is it's a super hidden gem. No one saw it. I mean, it eventually gained a momentum later on when Tarantino got more famous and people went back. And, you know, I remember when I was in school, it's so funny. I actually have these right here. I used to read these all the time when I was a few years back because this is the original scripts that they wrote. So True Romance, Quentin's script was actually nonlinear and Clarence dies in Quentin's script. And then this is a hell of a script if you haven't read it. The story behind Natural Born Killers is so interesting because he wrote a screenplay for it and Stone did his own thing with it and gave Tarantino a story credit. But if you actually get a chance to read Quentin's actual Natural Born Killers script before the Oliver Stone thing is pretty interesting.
I got to ask you a question about True Romance before you move on to your actual pick. You and Lauren went to some fan event, though, didn't you? Was that decently attended?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. We stayed in the room. So it was the Safari Inn which is where Clarence and Alabama go in the movie after essentially they're getting ready to do a drug deal with Michael Rapaport's character and the big time movie producer about the cocaine they have in their suitcase. And they go to this hotel Safari Inn, and there's they're there for a while, but there's a very there's a pretty nasty scene there, which is actually a scene I try to skip over when I watch the film, where her and Gandolfini fight, even though she comes out triumphant at the end. It's just a hard scene to watch. But that particular place you're referring to, yeah, they did like a anniversary meetup, and people got like Bronson Pinchot showed up, who has a great scene in True Romance, if you haven't seen it, where he gets pulled over by a cop and he sneezes, or someone sneezes and cocaine flies all over his face. Yeah, that is a very special thing, Safari Inn. My actual pick, though, is going to be Enemy of the State, because if we're talking personal, so we're talking favorite here, correct?
Favorite.
Yeah, favorite. Okay.
So Enemy of the State was a weird film. It came out at a time, I'm trying to remember the day, I think it was 98. And when it came out, I was 14, and my uncle, Steve, was visiting from New York. I'll never forget this, because you think about these random memories when it comes to films. And he was visiting from Long Island, him and my Aunt Char, or Aunt Char, however you want to say it. And we all went to AMC Hampton Town Center that day to see Enemy of the State. My brother, myself, my dad, and my uncle. And I remember walking out of Enemy of the State, I was so just like mesmerized by the way Tony Scott directs his films. The pacing, the music, the way he utilized colors and angles. It was just such a special movie for me. I don't know that I had seen True Romance by that point, because I was only 14. I think I was introduced to True Romance when I was in high school by my friend Chris. So Enemy of the State was always my quintessential Tony Scott movie. I was never a big Top Gun fan. I don't really love the first Top Gun, personally. I like it. I don't think it's a great film. I think it's very good, but Days of Thunder was more my speed, no pun intended. But anyways,
that is a pun, Kevin.
Unintentional.
The one thing I hate about Days of Thunder is that it starts on an outhouse, and says Charlotte, North Carolina.
I don't remember.
It's like podunk. And I mean, NASCAR is enormous here, and it ended up shooting a lot of stuff at our track. But yeah, it's like opening on a southern outhouse, and it's just Charlotte, North Carolina.
It's so funny. I haven't seen Days of Thunder in a long time, but that was like that was the movie of his I remember growing up on.
It does not hold up.
Yeah, I'll go back and revisit it. But Enemy of the State, if you haven't seen it, it's Will Smith, Gene Hackman, Jason Lee makes a little cameo in there. It's an excellent story, but it's also one of those movies where do you ever watch a film where a character gets in a situation and you just want so badly to go in there and tell everybody else around those characters that this character didn't do this thing that they're saying he did? So like, for example, like that to me is a very interesting thing a filmmaker can do. So when you're watching a story and somebody's like accused of something they didn't do, or and we know that they didn't do it, the audience does, but everyone else in the story thinks that person did something wrong or illegal. I always find that to be a very intense thing for an audience and a filmmaker transaction wise. I always love that I'm on the edge of my seat rooting for the person's innocence to come about. And I think that was an interesting thing about Enemy of the State, was the storyline, the way the story plays out. Gene Hackman's so great in it. Will Smith's amazing in it. Dan Mendel shot it. Mendel's the J.J. Abrams' guy who shot like Star Trek, and he did Star Wars episode 7 and 9. It's just truly a wonderful film. Great soundtrack, great score, really old. It's kind of Tony Scott before he started getting a little bit more extreme. Like the Deja Vu movies, and they started getting...
I'm so glad you said that, because Tony Scott does fall into Tony Scott traps in those later films.
But Enemy of the State was prior to that. So it's interesting, if you watch Tony's career, like Spy Game, which was great, Enemy of the State, Top Gun, True Romance, Days of Thunder, those had that Tony Scott feel, right?
Yeah.
But then he started venturing... Man on Fire... Oh my God.
He does like captions, you know, like,
wait a second. I have to change my pick now.
You're changing it to Man on Fire?
I'm changing it to Man on Fire.
You can't change it.
Forget about Man on Fire.
I had to just listen to a 30-minute monologue about Enemy of the State, and now you're going to do another one?
I'm not going to do another one, but I will say this. I love Enemy of the State, and that one has a more personal attachment to me because I was 14 with my uncle and my dad. But Man on Fire, if I'm being 100% honest, I would feel guilty about not clearing this up on the episode, so I'm going to do it. Man on Fire is my favorite Tony Scott movie outside True Romance. No question, now that I'm thinking about it more fully. Because I was actually harping on
you
more of the
emotion. You knew the game, didn't you?
Here's why. I'll tell you why. I know this is a disaster now, and Gabe's freaking out. But I'm so ADD. I've also been in this basement since 5:30 this morning, so I apologize. I'm going a little stir crazy, to be honest.
Wait, hold on. I want to ask Jake a question. Jake, is your pick Man on Fire?
Yes, my pick's Man on Fire. Okay. So like, I'm just going to sit here and listen to 45 minutes of Kevin's 18, because we heard True Romance, we heard Enemy of the State, now we're going to hear, we're eventually going to hear every single Tony Scott movie from Kevin.
I am not.
So there's not going to be nothing left to be said.
I am not going to go into Man on Fire because I'm going to let I actually didn't know that was Jake's pick, so my apologies. I didn't see that. Is that in the show notes? I didn't see it. I'm sorry.
No, I just, for some reason, I knew Jake was going to pick that. That's why I asked.
This is the only thing I'll say. Enemy of the State. That's kind of the more intentioned one, because on our show we always go back to personal reasons why we love certain things, and that one had a personal family thing for me. My dad and I love that movie together. So I get you guys can make fun of me, and you know, Kevin, you screwed.
No,
this
I just think it's funny that we just got 30 minutes on a movie that's not really
minutes.
Even your number one, but then we then recently found out that it's not even really your number two. So we just got 30 minutes on why Enemy of the State is your third favorite Tony Scott movie.
Hey, I'm being authentic, man. This is just what's happening in my head at the moment. The only thing I'll say about Man on Fire, and the reason why it's my favorite Tony Scott movie outside of True Romance, now that I'm remembering, is there's a line in the film. This is the last thing I'll say, and then I want Jake to actually take Man of Steel. Or Man,
I'm good, man.
Man on Fire.
Man on Fire is mine. Move on.
So there's a line in the movie where I think it's Christopher Walken. He's talking about the masterpieces that that the character, you know, his killing is his masterpiece, or killing is his art, and he's about to paint his masterpiece. So there's a moment in the film where Denzel goes upstairs into someone's random room with like a rocket launcher of some sort. And the guy in the room says to him, you know, essentially, why are you going to do this? Why are you going to kill somebody? And he said, don't you believe in forgiveness? And Denzel's character goes, what was the line, Jake? He goes,
forgiveness is between them and God.
Yeah.
It's just my job to arrange the meeting.
Yeah. There you go.
See, Jake? I know that line because it's my actual number one favorite Tony Scott film. Not my number two, not my number three, but my number one favorite Tony Scott film.
Jake, yeah. Tell us why.
I'm not sure I want to anymore. Here, all right, for the next 45 minutes, I will be explaining to you why.
I love how my rant went from 30 to 45 minutes in 2 minutes.
Because it just kept going. When the joke began, we were at 30 minutes.
You're wasting your time, Hamilton.
Oh, I will take every goddamn minute that I want to explain why Man on Fire is number one. Here's why Man on Fire is number one for me. It felt like, and you're right, at a certain point later in his career, Tony Scott kind of started really digging into the style. But Man on Fire felt like the first time that he discovered it. And it felt like he
That's
discovered
how I got
his
there.
Love of yeah. filmmaking all over again. And it felt like he stumbled into this like new style, and he just seemed so excited, but he still was able to like keep it constrained. He was still tinkering with different things. Even the way he presents subtitles. He presents subtitles for sentences said in English to emphasize certain things that they said. I think it is legitimately one of Denzel's most incredible roles, which says a lot for a performance like that. I think the score is absolutely incredible. Later on in his career, he would take this style, what I kind of refer to as the Man on Fire style, especially with like Domino and Deja Vu. And it kind of felt like every time I watched one of those movies, it just sort of felt like, dude, I get that you want this to be Man on Fire, but it's not Man on Fire.
Dude, I'm telling you, like the second time he did it, I was like, oh, we're doing this again?
Yeah, we're doing this Man on Fire. Like if he had just done that and then kind of gone back to like his 90s spy game and Enemy of the State style, I would have been like super cool with it. But it just felt like he discovered this new toy to play with and he didn't want to let it go. And not only did he not want to let it go, he wanted to hold it tighter and tighter with every movie that he made. But I just think I do love that particular style, and the way that he uses it in Man on Fire is pitch perfect. It's like, it's not overused. He's just kind of discovering what he can do with it. Just the way he edits it, it really feels like a filmmaker filmmaking. And I think I was writing for the newspaper at the time and doing top 10 lists. At the end of every year, it was my number one film of the year. It came out in April. It was my number one film all the way through the rest of the year. And I think that, yeah, there are countless incredible lines.
Interesting.
And the plot is intricate and complicated, but not so much that like you can't follow it. I remember being very surprised by, if you haven't seen it, I don't want to ruin it, but like what the resolution ended up being. And it really, it is a role that is perfectly suited for Denzel. One of his, I'd argue one of his probably top three or four roles.
But that line, Jake, when he says, that's between them and God.
See, I was more of a fan of the, when he's got the bomb up the dude's ass and he's strapped to the time. Car. And then he goes, and the guy goes, last wish, please, last wish. He goes, last wish, I wish you had more time.
Dude, do you remember the Unstoppable junket? Do you remember what? So it was the first time I ever interviewed Denzel, and this will actually give me a little bit of credibility as to why Man of Steel, Man on Fire. I am having the worst.
It's for the next 30 minutes. Sharks, we will be talking about why Kevin loves Man of Steel.
I can do that. Let's do that.
Anyways, I was.
Wait, do you like Man of Steel? I didn't think you liked Man of Steel.
I've come back around to it. Sure.
Oh, Christ, I can't keep track of any of you.
I have literally been sitting at this desk and this chair since 5:30 this morning. It's been 12 hours. I haven't even moved. I haven't had a break. I haven't eaten lunch. Nothing. That's why my brain's so scattered. But the last thing I'll say about Man on Fire real quick, though, is that you do have, like you said, Jake, Denzel's performance is incredible. When I interviewed Denzel for Unstoppable, Tony, the timer in the room, I was so nervous. I never met Denzel or interviewed Denzel ever. And I got three questions in and I got a wrap. So at the end of the interview, I have this on video. I looked at Denzel. I said, Denzel, they're wrapping me up. I wish we had more time. And he starts like dying laughing. And it was like one of my favorite, like, cause I was like, I got to use a line on him, but it made perfect sense for what we were doing. And that was just, I was so proud of that. I was so happy. Anyway.
Well, you're both wrong. And the correct answer is Crimson Tide. It's clearly
Tarantino.
The best movie that Tony Scott's ever worked on. Also my favorite of all time. For this reason, and I've talked about this on the show before, I love when actors just get to sink their teeth into amazing material. And Denzel is a lot of fun as the big bad guy in a lot of Ridley Scott and Tony Scott movies. The big persona, you know, that everybody sort of has to gravitate around. But in Crimson Tide, he gets to be overshadowed by Gene Hackman. And it's a little bit more fun to see Denzel have to push back on a bigger actor and to see those two go at it head to head. Like a lot of times when Denzel's in a scene with somebody, he's just the dominant force, right? And he's not with Hackman. Hackman overpowers him at every step of the way. I like the fact that Hackman had a rapport with Tony Scott already, and Denzel was starting to get into that. It's also one of those amazing situations where it's on a submarine, and I just hate the idea of submarines. I'm not comfortable in them. I would never be able to go in one. Because, Kevin, when you're talking about...
There's a U-boat here in Chicago. Would you ever go? And you can, like, walk through it. Would you ever go?
Oh, yeah. It's just stationary? Yeah. No,
it's underground.
That's fine. I have no problem with doing that. But, like, the idea of being in the middle of the ocean...
It's the water.
Oh, yeah. No, that's like, if something goes wrong, you can't get back... You can't... Like, when Cameron went down to the bottom of the ocean in his tiny little cart... You know, that terrifies me to no end. So I can't do that. But I also love in the script of Crimson Tide, first off, it's so beautifully constructed in that it's oh God, I almost made this joke. It's airtight. The script is airtight. But you don't know the entire time who's right and who's wrong. It's about this. Should they launch the nuclear codes or not? Did the communication that they get, was it accurate? And Denzel's trying to argue about the fact that they need to wait and, Gene Hackman's character is trying to push them along and you're not quite sure who's correct. And I love that. That type of, you know, gray area type stuff that drives the tension of that forward is fantastic. I prefer, while I do like that Man on Fire technique, I got tired of it by the time Tony Scott played it out. So I discredit those films a little bit just because they lean on them too much. I probably shouldn't. Man on Fire should get a lot of credit for being the first movie that did it. And I do think that's a really good film. I agree with Kevin. I don't think Top Gun's a great movie. It's seminal in the fact that it was huge at the time. When you go back and rewatch it, you're like, what the hell is this movie?
But it's almost a great time capsule of the 80s. Like if you were to like dig up like a decade in the ground and open it up, Top Gun would be a perfect representation of what that decade
was. For sure.
Was.
The way that they used Kenny Loggins' songs and just Cruise is like, he's such a movie star in that film, obviously. Yeah. But it's not a great film. I do understand.
Sean, I'm surprised you didn't ask Tarantino about Crimson Tide. I'm like, that would have been a cool discussion to have.
Yeah, we probably should have gotten into it. We had so much ground to cover. I almost went with Beverly Hills Cop 2. I really do like Beverly Hills Cop 2 a lot. It is a sequel that sort of builds on a template that worked, but the first one is still really, really good too. So I went with Crimson Tide. Audience picks. Let's see. We have Gannon Nordberg and Previn Naidu, who emails us every single week. They both said Enemy of the State. Martian Dance Hunter said Beverly Hills Cop 2. Michelle Garrist sent us an email. She said Spy Game. And John Palmer went with me for Crimson Tide. So obviously, a ton of really great films to choose from next week.
I change my pick again real quick, actually. I'm just kidding.
Kev's going to go with Gladiator.
That's Ridley.
Yes, I know, Kev. That was the joke.
I got to be honest. I'm with Kevin. I also thought, I was like, does she know that that's the difference?
I am so sorry for derailing that, guys. That was...
Well, not get like ready me. For next week, Kev, when you're going to really throw us off the rails because we're playing hashtag Best Picture Blend. You will let us know your favorite Best Picture winner of all time, either via email at realblend@cinemablend.com or play along on social media, hashtag bestpictureblend.com. No, not .com. Just hashtag Best Picture Blend.
We're all messing up, man.
Yeah, it's late. Our review is coming from SLC Movie Fan. What's the name of that Matthew Lillard movie?
SLC Punk.
SLC Punk? I hope that's who this is. I hope it's Matthew Lillard writing to us to call us the best
a little woozy here.
Movie podcast around. And they write, all of my life, I have been a total movie nerd. I love good movies, bad movies, weird movies, blockbusters, indie films, and everything in between. There's something special about the art form that allows us to explore so many different facets of ourselves and the world around us. Ever since I found this podcast after their incredible interview with Quentin Tarantino, I realized that other people feel the same way. These guys aren't movie snobs or purists. They just love cinema and all of the many parts that go into making it. They do a great job exploring what makes movies great technically, intellectually, and emotionally. They have amazing guests that offer a unique perspective into the movie-making process. Thank you guys for putting in all of the effort and commitment it takes to run such an amazing show. It is truly appreciated. So thank you, SLC Movie Fan. That's a fantastic
Wow, that really is.
Show. Yeah, that was really great.
If I were to write like a fake review for someone to be like, oh, this is what people think of us, I would write something like that.
There you go. Are you admitting that this was you who wrote this review? Yeah.
I really thought that the obscure Matthew Lillard performance were a reference would throw you guys off, but you nailed it.
I want to remind everybody about the bonus episode from Barry Sonnenfeld.
Yes, please listen to that. Please, 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 please.
So Barry, if people are only listening to the main show and are like, why am I going to listen to this? Barry did Men in Black. He did Get Shorty with John Travolta. He started his career with the Coen brothers, worked on Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, and one of Barton Fink. Was it Barton Fink was the other one?
He shot Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, and Blood Simple.
He shot Big.
He shot Big. He tells amazing stories of working with Tom Hanks. So, I mean, just a wealth of fantastic.
Also, I actually really like he did the Addams Family movies. I love the Addams Family movies.
The Addams Family. He explains how he gave the story of Forrest Gump to Tom Hanks, and then why he didn't take the movie, why he didn't direct it, and why he was back and said he's just a no BS guy. Like his stories are fantastic. He's been involved in a lot of amazing stuff. So if you haven't listened to the bonus episode yet, I'm sending everybody over there to go do that right now. So be sure to tune in next week. I think next week is Alicia Silverstone. Is that who's on the main show? Gabe is thinking about it. He's not sure. We're gonna have Alicia Silverstone on the show relatively soon.
At some point in the history of the show, Alicia Silverstone will be on it.
Boy, she's coming. So keep it locked here. Thank you for tuning in.
Wait, before we go, I really want to do a thing. Like, so in our video on YouTube, how are we situated? Is Kevin above me? No, he's to my right. Because I want to do like a he's to my left. I want to do like a Brady Bunch thing. Like,
goodbye, everybody.
Tenet. Tenet.
That sounded so good in my head.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.